Split show for you tonight. Next hour, Jason Martell joins me as we talk about his work with ancient technology and archaeology as well. When we come back in a moment with Nomi Prinz, we're going to take your phone calls and continue chatting about the incredible story of all the president's bankers. Nomi Prinz with us, all the president's bankers. Nomi, also, by the way, the book out available for people now.
Yeah, it's out. It actually sold out on Amazon, but it's waiting for reprints. It's on Barnes & Noble and .com, local places, and yeah.
Yeah, you've been getting a lot of exposure on this. It hits a nerve, doesn't it?
Yeah, and again, even though, I mean, I've been writing about this stuff for a long time, but actually looking at the real mechanics of how these people physically operate together, some elected, some completely not elected, or some appointed, is really been a fascinating research. Just even going to these presidential libraries and just looking at the documents and the collaborations that they entail, the letters, the transcripts. There's an enormous amount of power that exists in the financial community that has been levied on Washington and embraced by Washington as well over the years.
When you think back to your days on Wall Street, and then based on the research you've done for all the president's bankers, can you imagine if you had known then what you know now about how this stuff works?
I couldn't have been a part of it. I mean, I think even when I was in it, I was realizing that things were getting much more skewed to Washington, because I was there during the sort of Clinton years.
Yeah.
and into that, you know, and so I saw how important it was becoming, but I didn't realize how important, how prevalent it was, and particularly how it's pushed so much of just policy, whether it's war policy, whether it's debt policy, whether it's what happens on the ground here with respect to the population. It's eye opening, and I couldn't stomach it when I left the Wall Street period of my life. I certainly couldn't have stayed there as long as I had I been so aware of what was going on, and you know, just the history of it, and just the sheer amount of manipulation that goes on in what we consider to be a democracy.
You talk about how David Rockefeller, Chase Bank, might have been somewhat involved in the Iranian hostage crisis back in 79. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so this is just a fascinating thing. There's a system called the RAC system at the Jimmy Carter Library in Atlanta, and it basically is where all of the declassified documents show up in various different codes, and you kind of comb through, and I was looking for what was happening with the Rockefeller story, and David Rockefeller had been friends with the Shah of Iran in the mid-70s. And part of that was, I believe, because they were of similar ilk. You know, one was sort of a prince of America and one was a prince of Iran. But they skied together. They went to St. Moritz and Switzerland and they hung out. And this was in the mid-70s. By the time they got to the late 70s, and this is a quote from a book, Rockefeller's relationship with the Shah was so well known within the Carter administration that the White House decided to contact him about a possible visit to Iran, in which he could talk to the Shah about the political and financial situation there. So this is late 1978, a year before the crisis. So that's how much. And that was just one of many such documents in this RAC system that I found. So this is all precursor. When the Shah is ejected from his position, it's David Rockefeller and, to a lesser extent, Henry Kissinger and John McCloy, who was a former Chase chairman and very, very influential throughout the middle part of the 20th century and in many things, including the president of the World Bank and all sorts of things there. But they were trying to get the Shah to come into the United States, and this part is known. But what's a little bit less known is really the sheer amount of anguish this caused the Carter administration when they really didn't want the Shah to come in and so forth. And by the time he came in on the because he had cancer, and it was one of David Rockefeller's medical friends who wound up treating him in the United States. This unleashed what became the hostage crisis in Iran, which lasted for 444 days and into the beginning of Ronald Reagan's presidency, and certainly demolished Jimmy Carter's presidency. But what it came down to, why it was so volatile, was because it came down to money. David Rockefeller unilaterally decided during this process that he would reject a loan payment from the Central Bank of Iran, which pissed off the Central Bank of Iran, who had never defaulted on a loan. And David Rockefeller decided this on behalf of a syndicate or a group of a full amount of 12 international banks. So by himself, he decided this was how it was going to go, because he was just annoyed at what had happened with respect to the Shah. I mean, there was egos involved in this. And this precipitated a numerous amount of meetings inside the White House about how this could become a bigger international financial banking crisis, because all of these banks and their countries were annoyed at the United States because of what Rockefeller had done vis-a-vis Iran. So this is all the background. And by the time the hostage crisis was continuing and negotiations were happening to release the hostages, it came down to money with respect to Iran. It wasn't about the freedom of the hostages. There was an agreement that we will release them if we get certain monies back, including the monies that Chase basically screwed us out of and so forth. And that became a negotiation that lasted a really long time. So while people were waiting, hostages were waiting to get their lives back, to come back to the country, and Jimmy Carter was waiting to sort of save his presidency or his legacy, this was continuing to go on, even to the last moment. There's a few pages in my book that's just like the last minutes of the agreement finally being made and monies being not calculated properly and all the parties in between not trusting each other. And this was all because of what had started with the Chase Bank and what continued with the Chase Bank while Rockefeller was the head of it. Now, he denies a lot of his relationship with Ashaw in his own memoirs, in David Rockefeller's memoirs. But if I looked at all the documents, there was a hefty relationship there, and certainly one that impacted both the start of the hostage crisis and the fact that it lasted as long as it did, and the fact that it lasted into the Reagan presidency.
Just amazing how this politics works. Now, these huge banks today, can they ever be stopped, or is it too late?
We are at a position now where these big six banks, and I use the term six, there were the same big six banks in 1929, give or take a few banks, 1907, give or take a few banks. They today have 85% control, 85% of our deposits, of all institutions that take deposits in our country, 84% of all the bank assets in the country, and 96% of the derivatives that U.S. banks are engaged in our country, 45% globally. So the extreme amount of concentrated assets and deposits and derivatives and therefore wealth and power they have today is more than they've ever had before. What's less than we've ever had before is any sort of accountability as to what they do, any sort of anybody in jail, any real damages, any real dissection of these biggest banks to make them smaller, any requirement from the leadership in Washington to say, look, you guys screw the nation, here's what you need to do to make it right, here's what we're going to do to you if that doesn't happen. There has been none of that. So getting back to the question that you asked, whether they can be stopped, not right now, unfortunately, given the current leadership at the top of the banking system and the top of the political system, because they are so intertwined, they're so philosophically engaged, they so back each other, there's so little accountability on the side of either one of those two actors, that we are in a situation where they cannot be stopped. They have not been stopped. The 2008 crisis was an opportunity to, at the very least, make the biggest banks smaller, to at the very least dissect their ability to speculate with our deposits and our loans in the reckless manner that they had just shown, and the reckless manner that they are showing today that nobody's talking about, that's continuing to go on. And instead of making them smaller, instead of like beating them back, instead of throwing anyone in jail for all of the frauds that they've committed and all the settlements that they made, which didn't have anything to do with real criminal damage, we have let them become bigger. We, i.e. the leadership in this country, has let them become bigger. So it's a very scary point that we're in right now. They can only be stopped, unfortunately, if a bigger crisis happens that does a final wake-up call, like maybe the 1929 crash did when FDR came into power. And he actually worked with a banker. He worked with Winthrop Aldrich, who was the head of Chase at the time, who wanted the banks to be regulated, who wanted less speculation, because he believed that would be better for the stability of America, because he believed America needed that to grow as the banking system needed it to grow. We don't have that today. We have no accountability, and we have way too concentrated power in a very reckless way that Washington doesn't understand or won't deal with, and as the bankers certainly aren't going to curtail themselves.
Now we go to the phones. Eric is in Ashland, Oregon. Welcome to the program, Eric. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. Hello. Good evening.
Yeah.
Nomi, I've enjoyed you on Democracy Now! Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My question is, are you really sure that the Rothschilds are not as involved as you say? My understanding is that J.P. Morgan was actually a front for the Rothschild family, and that they represented the Rothschilds on Jekyll Island.
It is a very good question. Actually, J.P. Morgan was involved with representing part of the Rothschild constellation. Of course, I mentioned their English connections, and they had that connections in other countries in Europe as well, and histories there. So yes, there was an element of representation, but there was also a greater element, and this is what I found in my research, of wanting to be a separate power in his own right. J.P. Morgan was a very powerful banker here, and whatever his alliances were with the Rothschilds, and also his alliances with different forms of Morgan banks in both France and in England at the time as well, that were separate but also joint ventures with some Rothschild money behind them, he really wanted to forge ahead on his own. And when it came time for the Federal Reserve Bank to be created, the men that were at Jekyll Island, one man was connected more so to the Rothschilds, that was Paul Warburg. He was one of them. But the other three men were very much lieutenants of the very close American associations of J.P. Morgan. For example, a man named Frank Vanderlip, who's a fascinating and odd character in the book, who was working for National City Bank at the time. He was the number two guy there. The number one guy, James Stillman, who was a very tight connection with J.P. Morgan and also with the Rockefeller family, he had sent Frank Vanderlip as his lieutenant. And he had traveled for 2 years before the Jekyll Island meeting in 1910. So from 1908 to 1910, with Senator Nelson Aldrich, who was the one who presented the original plan, all throughout Europe having those meetings. But really, J.P. Morgan wanted his own power foothold in the world as well as in the U.S., which he was growing anyway, and the Federal Reserve or having a central bank to back him was the way to do that without having to rely on all the sort of wealth alliances that he had, whether it was from the Rothschilds or anything that was going on in Europe. It was a way for him to sort of emerge on a competitive basis. And that's really what wound up happening as America became more of a superpower throughout the century that followed relative to the century before, where Europe, and particularly England, was more of the financial superpower in the world.
The bailout of 2008, saving some of these banks, should they have failed? Should we have let them fail?
I think that had we let the ones fail that needed to fail, we would have had a more stable situation right now. Because what happened instead was not only was $700 billion worth of money okayed by Congress in the form of the TARP bailout, but trillions of dollars were provided through the Treasury Department and through the Federal Reserve in particular, that still holds $4.2 trillion of debt on its books, doing absolutely nothing but helping to alleviate the pain that the banks would face otherwise. So there continues to be subsidization and bailing out of this very flawed system. If we had not been using this policy, which is the Federal Reserve, the Treasury Department in Washington, to back a flawed system, but instead had dissolved whatever institutions needed to be dissolved or dissolved the components, the pieces, the fraudulent transactions, the toxic assets that were in these banks, and then separated those out from depositors and regular loan type of transactions with individuals, and fortified the mortgage loans that were faulty because they were criminal to begin with, I believe we would have had a much more stable environment now. And we also would have sent a message for the first time in history that if you're a big six bank, it doesn't matter, even if you have a political financial connection, even if it's existed and grown through family and then other types of alliances throughout the years, you're still accountable here for your mistakes. And you don't get to be subsidized by the government. But again, this is not the philosophy that our government had and not the philosophy that our government has. Had they would have maybe let another bank or two fail, or at least force them to, if they were to survive with this enormous amount of help, an epic amount of historic help, they would have had to give something back in return. And there was no accountability demand in return.
East of the Rockies, Michael in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hey, Michael, go ahead.
Yes, well, thank you. Naomi, 2 years ago, and I'm not going to mention names here, but I've already given the appropriate websites to George and his producer. But two years ago, I got involved with a series of conversations on radio about Paul Warburg, whom you were just talking about. And the host of that show had a brown paper bag delivered to him all consisting of secret congressional testimony concerning Mr. Warburg. And we talked for several days about the contents of those documents. And George, we need to talk later about this person, CK,
sure,
and my conversations with him. But these documents and another DVD that just came out last week, I'm not going to say the network, but it covers 120 stations, and talking about Paul Warburg, Christian stations, 120 of them. But I would like for you to get a hold of George. He has this information. I'm giving him permission to give it to you. But I would like for you to get back with him, compare those radio conversations between me and CK and what you just said about Paul Warburg and what this DVD that's now circulating about the creation of the Federal Reserve. The conclusion of the soon-to-be very popular DVD is that Mr. Paul Warburg did represent the Rothschilds, and that England, through the Rothschilds, has reconquered the United States of America.
Interesting take. What do you think, Nomi?
Well, no, as again, I mentioned that Paul Warburg of those men did have the strongest ties. And in fact, he was appointed. He was also friends with Woodrow Wilson. He was appointed to be one of the first Federal Reserve board members for two times, basically, because he was appointed and reappointed. So he also certainly had power in Washington. And certainly today, Tim Geithner, the last Treasury Secretary under President Obama before the current Jack Lew, is off working for one of the legacy Warburg fund management companies. So there's definitely a connection. There's definitely a long history of influence then. And as I said, he probably had the closer association to the Rothschild. I would have to look at those documents, to be honest, because I really, in terms of the analysis of what I have seen and the relationships, I've seen that the relationship of the U.S. relative to England in this post financial capitalism era, the post, you know, basically in the last century, has really moved in such a way that although there's a tremendous amount of banking that goes out of London and there's a tremendous amount of shadow banking that goes out of London, and it's certainly used for many activities that should be regulated and should be more transparent, that from a power perspective, that connection, that power connection that I talk about specifically, the political financial entity of power, still, I believe, has increased in the U.S. relative to Great Britain, but I would be happy to, you know, look at that information, because I do think that all of the relationships of the families, in particular the ones of legacy families and their money, that have consistently been influential on the financial side as well as the political side, is an onion that needs to continue to be peeled, and there's a lot of information that I believe is still there to be examined.
Nomi, hang on. We're going to take this quick break. Then we're going to come back and take some final phone calls with you. Nomi Prinz, our special guest, her latest work, All the President's Bankers. When we come back, let's talk a little bit about the 2016 potential presidential candidates and how the bank community will react to either one of them. You know the two big names, so we'll talk about that when we come right back. And by the way, follow us and like us on Facebook and Twitter. Simply go to coasttocoastam.com. In the far right-hand corner, just click those icons, and there you are. Well, one of the fastest internet-based television programs beyond belief is available for you. Peek at it for 10 days free. Look at all the other programs, too, and enjoy yourself. Simply go to this website, beyondbelief.com, and sign up. That's beyondbelief.com. Welcome back to Coast. Nomi Prinz with us, her work, All the President's Bankers. So, Nomi, assuming in 2016 it's a Hillary Clinton, Jeb Bush presidential race, as a lot of people are beginning to predict now, even though it's very early, do they both have banking connections?
Oh, absolutely. And what's interesting is they both have different banking connections. Although Wall Street supports both of them, it'll be happy with either one of those two people. But those connections happen to come from, again, this long line. The connection that would run into Jeb Bush is the same connection that really helped both of the other Bushes get into office, which was the sort of Merrill Lynch, Bank of America, that component of the connection. And then J.P. Morgan Chase could go either way. Goldman Sachs, of course, has been a longtime supporter, really, of both, but in terms of fundraising and campaign contributions and rallying other types of large contributions, they've been pretty much for the Clintons since making Bill Clinton a president. His first relationships that made him even a player in Wall Street, where he needed to be a player before he ran in 1992, came through a couple of individuals at Goldman Sachs. And it was no accident, therefore, that he then put his first Treasury Secretary choice was Robert Rubin, who was from Goldman Sachs. These people put the Clintons in power. They put the family Clinton in power. And so Hillary Clinton, for example, at the end of last year, was talking to a couple of different Goldman Sachs gatherings for a large sum, two large sums of money, and basically telling them that, you know, that we kind of got this whole thing wrong, that maybe Wall Street wasn't so to blame for the crisis. You know, there was a lot of shared blame to go around. So she's been pretty clear on what she would do in office, which would be the same thing everyone has done in office, which would be to let the banks continue to do what they're doing. And the whole fact that they're supported by us, subsidized by the Fed, and all of that together doesn't really mean anything. Jeb Bush would do nothing different. He might just have additional support from sort of Merrill Lynch Bank of America contingent, because that's been where the historic power into the Bush family has lied. But I, honestly, it's going to be tough for Wall Street to decide who to support of these two, because they don't really, either one of them would be a mark of status quo on this political financial alliance, as well as the power that the financial community has because of it, and also because of the way that both families have orchestrated their decisions with respect to Wall Street in office and how they would going forward. And President Obama is just kind of in between it. Most of the people in his cabinet anyway were Clinton retreads, from Larry Summers, who was his economic advisor, who had been a Treasury Secretary under Clinton, to Janet Yellen, his appointee for the Federal Reserve, who had worked as well under Larry Summers and the crew at the Clinton administration. So that's kind of in history, that's going to be a blip into Clinton. But the support to him, even in his campaign, came from J.P. Morgan and from Goldman Sachs relative to other banks.
You don't touch on the BCCI bank scandal, but how could a bank that big collapse like that?
Well, the interesting thing about BCCI is its history, and I don't touch about it so much in the book, but it really stems back to these years of the 70s when banks were being created in order to really funnel the petrodollars that were coming out of the Middle East through London into the global community in different ways and to create quite a lot of profit through that bank, through BCCI, as well as all of the banks that were doing the same sort of thing. It just did it in a bigger way. And it certainly melted in one of the biggest frauds and scandals that we've seen in recent years, as well as resulting in customers having large jail sentences as well. So it's certainly a sign of what has continued from the 70s on to today, of this idea of fraud collecting in the international community because of what stemmed out of this vast pool of new money coming out of the Middle East through oil and through petrodollar recycling. And that became more complicated as derivatives became more complicated and the financial markets themselves became more complicated, and more fraud was a component of doing business, which it always had been. It just was done at a more epic level. And then BCCI melted because it was so tied into all sorts of those frauds and all those different derivative connections and all the complexities that were really, you know, sort of came home to roost in one institution. And it didn't have the same type of subsidy, for example, that a JP Morgan Chase would have when it was buckling, which it did in the 2008 crisis, or the Bank of America had, or the Citigroup had, which were, again, very much supported by the U.S. government and therefore subsidized by us and by policy.
So many inside politics. My gosh. Let's go to the phones. We go next to Jack in San Diego, west of the Rockies. Hey, Jack, you're up with us. Go ahead.
Yes. Yeah, so the President of the United States appoints the members of the Federal Reserve Board. They're confirmed by the Senate. The President can't even fire them. The only way they can be removed is through impeachment by the Senate, or their term expires. The oversight is conducted by Congress. So the President and the Treasury Department effectively have no, zero operational control over the Federal Reserve Board and its member banks. Even the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 transferred the currency to the Federal Reserve. We went from U.S. Treasury notes to Federal Reserve notes, and the power to print was transferred to the Federal Reserve.
Right.
So when you say all the president's bankers, it kind of leaves you with the connotation that the president has some type of operational control or power over the banks, and I would contend he doesn't.
Well, he doesn't now. Well, now the concentration of the banks and their power is so high that there's no control. There's no requested accountability. But back in some periods of history, there was a quid pro quo. For example, and going back to LBJ in the 60s, he wanted to push the Great Society and all of his measures for that, and his tax measures for that, that Kennedy before him had not been able to push because Kennedy wasn't as associated with the bankers and they didn't promote his policies to the extent that LBJ did a whole sort of you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours policy, which enabled bankers to, for example, get U.S. policy, foreign policy to back their expansion into Latin America, which became a disaster. But it also allowed LBJ to request from them that they support in Congress. They push their senators, they buy their senators to vote for the policies that he was trying to push through with respect to the domestic policy, with respect to tax policy. So when I talk about all the president's bankers, there are a lot of these connections and relationships over time where one is helping the other, one is requesting from the other, one is demanding from the other. They're both trying to promote their own power bases as well, absolutely throughout the entire period. Today what we have is situation where they're starting to promote their own power base. The Federal Reserve, though it isn't accountable, I mean, it's theoretically, yes, as you said, it could be. We've never had anyone impeached by, you know, at the top of the Federal Reserve, and that's not going to happen. The reason it's not going to happen is because of how it was constructed. And it was constructed by two presidencies, effectively, the Taft presidency and the William Wilson presidency, and a bunch of bankers. And initially Senator Aldrich, but then ultimately Senator Glass took it forward, and the Federal Reserve Act was part of how Glass massaged the Aldrich Act because they just wanted it to sound like it came from a Democrat president instead of a Republican president and so forth. But it was formulated in order to back and preserve the banking system. It was formulated to give it the power that it has, but it was formulated by decision that also came through the presidents at the time. And a lot of the policy decisions in between, for example, going into World War One, going into World War Two, how do we finance it? Federal Reserve was a part of some of that, but in the initial stages, it was still very much part of the bankers pushing the presidents and the presidents collaborating because they believed that the bankers and private financing was required beyond the Federal Reserve to expand American power globally. So there's a lot of nuances and impacts of the relationships that normally the big six bankers of any particular era, those are the ones I looked at through all of the presidential libraries that I went to from Teddy Roosevelt through George Bush, the first, because the other ones, through Clinton, because the other two haven't been opened yet, and look to find is how policy in a wealth of different areas was really impacted by these alliances. And so there is a lot of connection between the two. And though today bankers have more concentrated wealth, and that's why we're in such a dangerous position. They control more than they've ever controlled before. This has been something that's accumulated over the century because of these connections, because of these alliances, because of similar ideologies, and just allowing it all to happen, that it doesn't now. And I say this at the end of the book, it doesn't really matter who's president now, which is what I was saying before. It doesn't matter if it's Jeb Bush or Hillary Clinton, because they're going to do the same thing vis-a-vis Wall Street, which is to let it continue to fester and grow in this very reckless, dangerous, and concentrated manner. So we're at this period where for the past couple decades and getting worse and worse every day, everything that's accumulated throughout this century is accelerating in the direction of bankers having more and more power, and the president now, not just being powerless, being a part of that power, but not caring to even pretend to put any accountability on these bankers. And that's what's really become the policy under both political parties.
This, now, in terms of the average person, Naomi, the middle-class America, all the politics of the bankers, does that affect them at all?
Well, it does, because what happens is every time a decision is made to bail out a bank, to deregulate some aspect, to gloss over what could be an accounting rule, to pretend that these banks aren't bigger today than they were in 2008, the Big Six. Every time that happens, it chips a little bit away at our economic stability in the population. The fact that we have 0% interest rates right now has not been something that's funneled in to help most individuals in the country. It's helped the banks sort of resurrect themselves, as well as has the fact that the Federal Reserve's been buying securities that are bum securities from the banks because no one else wants them, which also continues to fund them. But it's not really funneled into us. The idea that the banks were going to have this opportunity to be rejuvenated, which was what was sold to us by Washington under both presidents, both recent presidents, and that that somehow would trickle down to the rest of the economy, hasn't really happened. What's happened is the banks themselves have $2.5 trillion of cash sitting at the Federal Reserve doing absolutely nothing with respect to the rest of the economy. And so this idea that the policy allows this to happen, it takes money that could be used for our purposes, whether that's for infrastructure, whether that's for small businesses, whether that's to help restructure loans, whether they're mortgages or whether they're student loans or whatever it might be. This is not funneling into the general economy. It's really just staying in the hands of this concentrated few. So from a financial standpoint, it's negative to the rest of the population. And also just from a sheer democracy standpoint, it's negative to the population because it just means that all of this concentrated power and policy continues to act on its own behalf and its own best interest, which is the senior bankers of Wall Street's interest and the people in power that they support and vice versa, rather than looking at what's more of a population interest. And in the middle part of the 20th century, for example, even whether it was under a Democrat president or under a Republican mm-hmm. president, say Eisenhower, there were infrastructure projects. There was some accountability with respect to restraints on the banking system to disallow them to just simply speculate and have the government hold the tab or have the population hold the tab. That doesn't exist today, and that's why it affects us. That's why even if we don't understand the ins and outs of banking, it affects all of us every day.
Next up, let's go to Harry in Port Huron, Michigan, east of the Rockies. Thanks, Harry. Go ahead.
Good morning, George. Thank you for this topic.
Sure,
I would say to your guest and everybody else listening, we can stop these banks, the Big Six that you mentioned, and we can stop them as soon as this week. If the American people that have their money in those banks, and I don't get paid for this, what I'm going to say now, if the American people who have the money in those banks would take their money out of those banks this week and go to a credit union and open up an account, we could close those banks down in a heartbeat. We can do something about this.
What do you think of that?
That is an excellent thought. And I think for the past decade or so that I've been writing about this, that other people have it, that you and I'm sure the people in your community who listen to you feel the same way, and lots of people throughout the country, I would imagine, do as well. And then there's the other side of the rest of everyone in the country who is afraid to do that or has somehow tied into this idea that it's just easy and the technology is there and I have a mortgage here and I can have a loan here and all this stuff is easy. And you're right. If we take money into community banks, into smaller financial trusts, into regional banks, into a public banking type of system, that does take power away. It requires a mass awakening. The knowledge of what we've been discussing here to permeate millions, tens of millions of people with accounts, at least to start with, and to do that. Because what's happening is, unless we have a full awakening, and that's kind of what happened in the 30s. I mean, yes, we had a depression, but you had a lot of people whose banks were closing, who were pounding on doors, who were afraid, who were scared, who put FDR in office, and also had him hold the bankers accountable and the bankers get on his page to stabilize the situation and to not have the same concentration continue, at least for a little bit during those decades, and to not have it as risky. And it was kind of a counter check. We don't have that today, and I agree. If everybody listening to the show actually talks to everybody else in their circle, we could probably get a lot of stuff going. And until and if that doesn't happen, then we're in the situation where these Big Six institutions and their political financial alliances do hold too much power.
Let's take a few more calls here. Let's go to Carlos in Carson, California, Wildcard Line. Carlos, go ahead.
Yes, good evening, Naomi and George. Naomi. Some scholars reference the fact that back in 1773, there was a very mysterious meeting led by Amschel Rothschild, where he congregated the leading industrialists of Europe, and they made a plan for the creation of a world government. a central, a paramount to this creation of the world government would be the creation of central banks, which will give them control over the economies of nations and drive the nations into huge debts through wars and so on and so on, to eventually lead to the collapse of these nations, so that then they would become susceptible to world government. And of course, the Rothschilds immediately opened up the central banks of Italy, France, Germany, Austria, and then they tried the United States with a 20-year charter through Alexander Hamilton, but that failed. But eventually, through the partnership with the Rockefellers, Morgans, Warburg, and others, we were able to control the Federal Reserve. And if we look at today, the world is in debt by $600 trillion.
Right.
We pull it to the Rothschilds. We are susceptible to the world government that they've been planning, even though many scholars contend that that meeting never took place. The evidence is here. We are ready for a collapse and the installation of a world government.
We have a world political financial alliance, which is like a world government. The population may think we're voting for, but as I mentioned before, that would be in a democracy in which the majority vote actually means something with respect to finance and policy in general, and it doesn't because of this concentration of power. And yes, all of these countries are super indebted, and the policies, particularly lately, what's happened is because of the extent of the derivatives market and all these complex financial securities, that the ability to screw around with economies and currencies and subprime loans and, you know, municipalities and so forth, it's so much more extreme than it's ever been before. In 1700, whatever was imagined, whatever was written, could probably never have actually comprehended the extent of $693 trillion derivatives market, which far exceeds the GDP of the world, and that doesn't even count for the fact of all the inequality within each individual country, which ours, for example, is rising to 1920s heights, which is very, very scary, as well as the general inequality of all the nations in the world. The institutions of, for example, the World Bank and the IMF, which were created in the wake of World War II, were created by the governments that are now controlling the banking systems of the world, and that's no accident. That's part of what's been culminating in history. And even at the time, I mentioned John McCloy before, he became the head of Chase, and it was involved with the Rockefeller family at the time. But at the time, he asked, he demanded that if he were going to be the president of the World Bank, this was in its beginning stages, he demanded from Harry Truman that Wall Street be the mechanism through which World Bank bonds would be circulated. And what this meant was this just reestablished, reconfirmed the fact that it would be private financial concerns that would dictate which countries were indebted, by how much, the terms of those loans. And even though you have an institution that most people on the outside might think of because they don't really study the real mechanics, like we're discussing here, might sound like, oh, this is just something that's helpful to countries, blah, blah, blah. The fact is it's not. It's a mechanism of all this consolidation of wealth into the hands of a few.
Nomi, good luck. All the president's bankers, excellent job. Nomi Prinz, up next. Jason Martell joins me. We're going ancient technology hunting.